This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Sexy and Surreal, a David Lynch and David Cronenberg podcast. I'm Joe Lipsit, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Terry Menard. Hi, Terry.
Hey, Joe. So I unfortunately have a confession. You know this, but for our listeners, I did not get to watch the intervening episodes, except for I did watch the last episode.
Okay.
So yeah. I do want to go back and finish up the show. I really do. I know I said that. But I honestly do. This last month has been
it's kind of hellish.
But I do want to watch it, particularly after watching the last episode. I really want to go back and fill in some of the pieces.
Yeah, I appreciate your dedication, considering that we have spent a lot of time in Twin Peaks and you haven't always loved some of this experience. But I think if nothing else, we're going to be able to have a pretty fulsome conversation to talk about, yes, folks, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the 1992 prequel movie that David Lynch directed, which clocks the last 7 days of Laura Palmer. And I feel like I spend so much time saying, don't worry, Terry, you don't need to finish season two because you'll still be able to grasp most of what's going on in this film.
So when I was watching the final episode, there was a lot going on that I was like, I don't really know where everyone is.
No.
Like Heather Graham is there and I had not been introduced to her.
Nope.
The thing that like made me cackle, though, I have to say, is that in the final episode, I was curious when we left off when Nadine would get her mind back or her memory back. And it happens literally in the last episode.
Yeah.
And that made me laugh that it was stretched out for the entire rest of the season with her thinking she's a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just a bunch going on in that second season. Some people really like it. A lot of folks feel like the wheels just kind of fall off when Lynch takes that creative step back. And, you know, to the point where when we get to Fire Walk With Me, there's a bunch of actors who are quote unquote missing. And over time, it came out that several of them refused to come back because they felt like they had been abandoned by David Lynch and Mark Frost, and that that second season of Twin Peaks just didn't live up to the promise that they felt it could have if he had been more involved. So it's a shame. You know, I think when you watch Fire Walk With Me, I see Moira Kelly on the screen and I think she's not a bad Donna, but she's not
but
Laura
she's
Flynn
not Donna.
Boyle, and it's really distracting to me.
Yeah, I did not. So I went in kind of blind watching this one. So I didn't look up Wikipedia and I didn't look up the information behind it. And I was like, wait, that's not Donna.
Who is that?
Who is this character? And I literally paused the movie because I was like, wait, what is happening? And I had to go look it up. And then I realized that, you know, she'd been recast as Donna for the movie. And then I started digging in the fact that like Kyle MacLachlan didn't want to get typecast. So his role was reduced. It sounds like Mark Frost and Lynch had some issues and he kind of stepped away from this one. So like there's a lot of drama before the movie even starts or was even, you know, going to be filmed.
Well, yeah. And let's not forget that this film was never a guarantee. So they were never sure whether they were going to be able to get a season three. And then when ABC cancels the show, it sounds like it came together relatively quickly. As we'll discuss when we finally get to Mulholland Drive, it's the same kind of sweetheart deal where a French production company swoops in, offers David Lynch a certain amount of money to say, we want your vision, we want to see the story continue. And then what we get is Fire Walk With Me, which of course is a notorious bomb when it comes out. Critics are completely divided because they feel like in some ways it's completely nonsensical. Why isn't it giving us the story that people wanted? This is Lynch through and through, right? Where he says, I'm still invested in this world and particularly the world of Laura Palmer, but I'm also not interested in continuing any of the plot threads that we just abandoned at the end of season two. Instead, I'm going to give you this prequel, which maybe tells us a story we already know, and yet I would argue, and I think the critical reappraisal over the years justifies this, this was a story worth telling.
Absolutely. And there's two points I kind of want to clue in. Before we do dive into Fire Walk With Me, I just want to say that watching the ending of season two with Cooper laughing in the mirror, and it's kind of revealed that maybe he's the doppelganger and Cooper is still stuck in the lodge.
Yep.
And I thought that was a great ending. I would have been, so if I were watching this now and this was like the ending of a TV show, I would have been happy because yes, it doesn't give me closure. Yes, it doesn't tie up some loose ends, but it still gives me enough and it gives me a fun little stinger of a note to end on that I was like, wow, I would love to see more, but I'm happy. So that's one thing I wanted to throw in with that, with the ending of this series. And then going into Fire Walk With Me, I was really shocked to find out that it seemed like no one really liked this on release because this movie does such a great job of sort of filling in the missing pieces of Laura while making her a real person while also like giving us how everything kind of came together. It literally solves the mystery of Laura Palmer's death in 2 hours. In a
satisfying fashion, right?
Yeah. Yes. I was really surprised when I saw the reaction to this because I was like, this is literally what I would have thought the audience would have wanted to see.
Yeah, I think in part it's because by the time the film comes out, it's about a year and a half after we had quote unquote already solved the murder, right? So the last episode we talked about with Twin Peaks was that episode 207 where we get the reveal that Leland Palmer, aka her father, was the killer. And I think people felt like, oh, this is the answer. I don't need to care about this anymore. So people had either lost interest or they felt like this wasn't the Twin Peaks story that they wanted to continue. But I'm completely with you. If you were a true fan, or specifically if you were mostly invested in the Laura Palmer murder, this movie is quite literally giving you exactly what you always complained about throughout season one and then part of season two.
Exactly. So when we left off the last time, we did find out that Leland is Bob, or that Bob is possessing Leland. I know that it continues on for a couple more episodes in terms of Leland's capture.
Right.
I don't know if this gets answered, but when I left that, I was like, okay, so I know the who, but what's the why? And I feel like this movie does a good job. I mean, maybe it gets answered in those episodes and that's why people are upset, but I felt like this gave me a really good reason of what was going on with Bob, the motivations a little bit more, and felt it really tied in all of these characters in like Ronette and Laura in ways that I found very fulfilling.
Right. Yeah. Because the TV show was so, it was so large, right? It was really telling the story of secrets in this small town, but it had a cast in at least the 20s in terms of balancing act, different storylines, and so on. And by paring that down, and yes, folks, we will acknowledge that, of course, there is another version of Fire Walk With Me called The Missing Pieces, which features a lot more footage of some of the TV show regulars, which, of course, Lynch ended up excising for runtime and pacing and all that other stuff. So we're not going to be talking about The Missing Pieces. We didn't watch it for this episode. If folks want to write us in and tell us a little bit about their thoughts for it, we'd be happy to hear it. But for the purpose of just Fire Walk With Me, the 2 hour and 14 minute cut, you know, we've got a 28 minute quote unquote prologue at Deer Meadow, which doesn't feature almost anyone that we know except for Dale Cooper when he gets pulled into the Teresa Banks investigation. But aside from that, we're getting nearly an hour and 45 minutes of Laura, her life, you know, her relationship with James, with Donna, with Bobby, you know, all of the things that the series alluded to, but never really had a lot of time to dig into because it was trying to keep 20 other storylines juggled.
I do want to talk about that opening prologue because I really, really enjoyed it. But
oh, good.
I love this movie. I love this movie. I was really surprised at how much I really dug this movie. But before we dig into that prologue, I did want to kind of jump off of a point that you made that as I was watching this after I was watching this and I was sitting with it, I was like, and I was trying to figure out why it didn't resonate with audiences. And I'm wondering if part of it might be because while we are seeing Laura, we are seeing the warts and the blemishes. She has become more than just the dead girl that is wrapped up in a piece of plastic at the start of the show that we know nothing about. We sort of peel back some of the storyline of her and figure out a little bit about her and her kind of troubled past of being, you know, an underage sex worker and the drugs and the, all of that kind of stuff. We get a little bit of that, but it is counterbalanced with the very zaniness of the town and humor. And this movie, after we get past the prologue, is completely devoid of humor. And it is just basically showing Laura Palmer, warts and all, and showing the decline of her and her eventual death. Like, it is a downward spiral of a movie. And that might not sit well with audiences.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think if this film had to come out in a different time period, like almost more removed from the end of the TV show, when people could have accepted it for what it was as opposed to what they felt it wasn't, which is a season three, which is addressing all of the cliffhangers of the TV show.
Right.
I think people might have accepted it more, but also you're right. This is not a happy film. And I think that's why it's actually done better over time, is because not only do people now know what it is and they can appreciate it for what it's giving them, but I feel like we're also specifically, like, I want to say since about the 2000s, maybe even a little bit later, we're more appreciative of stories that give us complicated female protagonists, teenage protagonists, and we're not so afraid of movies that are willing to dip their toe into sadness, grief. Like, you know, it's in some ways a little bit cathartic for me as somebody who really likes this movie that we can, you know, read interviews with Cheryl Lee talking about how survivors of incest have come up to her and said that the film is really important to them, because that's not something you're going to get upon release of a film like this, right? The story's just going to be, oh, it's a bomb, nobody wanted this. But over time, people can look at it and say, no, this film is actually doing a lot with some really dark shit, and the people who get it really, really like it.
And I honestly think that that is probably why it both resonated with me, but also why it might not have resonated with audiences, because kind of going back to the incest and the rape and the sexual violence that is in this, implied. It's implied in the show, and it's kind of talked around because this is a show that is made for ABC television, whereas this is an R-rated movie where, you know, there's nudity, there is a lot of nudity. I was surprised by that. A lot of, you know, foul language. Like, this is more of a David Lynch film than I think I was expecting. I didn't know that it was released in theaters. I did not know that it was, I really thought that this was like another made for TV type of movie. I did not know going into this that this was like a big David Lynch theatrical release film.
Oh, that is wild. Yeah. Yeah. The gloves are definitely off in the way that I think if this had been made for TV, it would have been more of what you probably expected, right? It would have been almost a continuation of the TV show. We would have had to dance around some of these things, because as we talked about in Maddie's Attack by Leland Palmer, that is harrowing, even though you're really not seeing that much. It's all in the way that David Lynch shoots it. Here, he's unrestrained and he can actually go for it. And it helps that, you know, none of these actors are convincingly teenage. So when I look at Cheryl Lee, I'm not really seeing her as a teenager because she looks like she's in her mid-20s. But at the same time, the story and the character are very much steeped in that. Like, this is Laura younger than we've ever seen her. And the things that she is going through are so fucking awful. Like, I feel like this movie is about a girl who is not only realizing that she is a victim of incest and her father is raping her since age 12, but also she is careening towards the edge of a cliff. Like, the whole movie, you're waiting for her to die and you know it's inevitable. Yep. And that is so fucking hard to watch.
I was just going to say that, because when I was watching this film, I had like a pit in my stomach because I know how it's going to end. You know that she is going to end up in the plastic bag, wrapped up, dumped in the lake by her father. You know that this is where it's heading. So I'm like, I'm sitting here watching this and I'm like, this just, it's made me feel very uncomfortable, which is what I think the movie is trying to do. I think is trying to let you sit with the fact that this character that we've barely ever seen. We've seen like the actress, but the character herself, we've barely seen her. Mm-hmm. We've just seen her in like VHS clips and a couple like weird, surreal moments. But this is like, no, this is a person. This is her life. This is the last few days of her existence on this earth. And I'm going to make you sit with it for like an hour and 40 minutes. And it's uncomfortable. It's, it was very uncomfortable watch.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned that you like this opening. So
I sure do.
It's funny that it gets called a prologue because it's, you know, it's lengthy. But I feel like I've seen some people say, well, you could just kind of chop off the Deer Meadow stuff because as gorgeous as Chris Isaac is, you know, as interesting as Kiefer Sutherland is, do we need this since we already technically know about the Teresa Banks stuff? Like we knew there was another body with a letter underneath a fingernail and that kind of stuff. So I'm curious, Terry, what are your feelings about this prologue?
I mean, that's a very loaded question because there's a lot of things I love about this. So let's take it back to the opening, because when it started and we have this gorgeous, gorgeous theme song playing that was, you know, composed by Angelo Badalamenti. Oh my God. Why do I always fuck up people's last names?
It's a hard name.
Angelo Badalamenti.
You got it.
I believe. Okay. Woo. All right. So I'm just going to say Angelo from now on.
Sure.
But we have this gorgeous theme from Angelo that I was immediately struck. I was sitting back and I was like, huh, I expected this to be the Twin Peaks theme, and it says not the Twin Peaks theme. There's a little bit of it kind of peeking through in a couple parts, but this is a completely different theme. And I'm like, okay, what is going on here? And we open up in Deer Meadow as opposed to Twin Peaks. We have these two, you know, FBI agents there. Chris Isaac, as you mentioned, is stunningly gorgeous.
Oh my God, he's so pretty.
I was just taken aback by how beautiful that man was in this movie. What I loved about this is that it has some similar beats that we expect from Twin Peaks. You know, there's a diner, but we go to the diner and there's this really funny exchange with Irene, who is smoking a cigarette. And it seems like this is another dimension, like the parallel universe to Twin Peaks, where everything in Twin Peaks seems to be sort of like, oh gosh, gosh, darn it, you know, and golly gee willikers. And this is like, she's smoking a cigarette. She is saying, do you want to hear our specials? There aren't any. Like that made me really laugh. Considering how like Cooper was on a quest for the best damn cup of coffee, and we get here and the Carl gives them a cup of Joe that is like disgusting.
Yeah.
It just like these little contrasts with it just made me laugh, and just like I was like, I wanted to spend more time in this world because it reminded me that David Lynch is kind of a troll, and this 100%. Felt like him fucking with the audience a bit in such a delightful way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will confess, I've only seen this movie a couple of times, but I often forget about this opening because I remember so much of it being about Laura and how harrowing it is. But yeah, when we get to spend a little bit of time with Agents Chester Desmond, that would be Chris Isaac, as well as Sam Stanley, that's Kiefer Sutherland. The problem with this, which is also a strength, is that we spend so much time with them that they actually become full-fledged characters. Like, these actors are doing a really good job of embodying them to the point where I suddenly get really invested in this investigation. I want to see more of them. And then, yeah, Lynch is fully trolling us. He just yanks them out of this movie. You know, Chester Desmond has disappeared. And you think, okay, well, we'll find him later, or he'll be a part of this film. You know, he'll come back and work with Agent Cooper. Nope. They're just completely gone from this movie. And you're like, is it important? Why did we spend this time? Why did you make me invest in these people? But you're right. The contrast is everything, right? It's not just setting up the film and getting us back into this world. It's saying, oh, these are real places. Like Twin Peaks is not a mystical other dimension like the Lodge. It's, you know, it's a little bit kooky, but so is this other town.
And I will also say that I do think that as a bridge, this little prologue does a great job of sort of keeping the tone of Twin Peaks going, because, you know, when they get off on the out of the airplane and there's this woman in dressed in red and she has a sour face and she's dancing and doing all this stuff. I was like, okay, This is Twin Peaks. Like, we literally open up the movie with David Lynch as, you know, Gordon, and he, of course, he's hard of hearing, so he's shouting and he's trying to get people on the phone. I'm like, okay, we're totally back in Twin Peaks territory. Yep, we're back, exactly. The band's back together. And it continues for a little bit in this little prologue, and then it's like there's a break, and all of a sudden, all of the frivolity that I believe is like par for the course for Twin Peaks is gone. And so it's just, I think it does an interesting job of sort of bridging, okay, this is the universe that you expect, and now let's kind of peel back that image of what we think of Twin Peaks and just focus on the rotten inside that is happening to Laura Palmer. So I think it's a very smart way of doing things. Yes, I can understand people would not necessarily appreciate it, but I do think that it's a very interesting reversal of expectation within a reversal of expectation.
it's Lynch being Lynch, right? I can't imagine buying a ticket for this as a fan of Twin Peaks and sitting through nearly a half an hour with barely a glimpse of Agent Cooper and feeling, you know, oh, okay, I guess this movie is doing something completely different, even though you look at the poster and it's Laura Palmer with the broken necklace on it and everything. Yep. And it's fantastic. It's very trolly, but it also feels exactly on point for what you would expect from a Lynch film. It's just you have to either accept it or you have to sit back and let it come to you.
Exactly. And I also think that it does give us a little bit of history to sort of show that there is something horrible happening, not just in Twin Peaks, because we have another dead blonde girl. Mm-hmm. This one is delivered up on, you know, on an autopsy slab. Her mouth is still open in a scream. Her eyes are staring.
That corpse is a plus level practical effects.
Yes, it really is. And the fact that there's this brief moment where, you know, they realize that she's missing a ring because the skin color is a little bit different where the ring was sitting. Mm-hmm. And they move her arm to take a look at it, and the arm cracks. It was like this very quiet moment, but I was like, rigor mortis. Like, it is making you feel that this body is no longer human, that it is whatever made it alive is gone, and the bone is cracking as he is trying to move it to look at it. I was like, that is a small but a very creepy detail.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other elements that gets introduced in this prologue is additional spirits. And I think this is another element where people could look at it and say, I don't really get it. What is he trying to accomplish? As though it wasn't enough to have Bob or the man from another place. All of a sudden now we've got, you know, this Miss Chalfont and her grandson who wears the mask over his face and is always jumping around. So we're also building out a little bit of the mythology. And this is important because we will see some of these, maybe not these characters, but this idea that there is an almost spirit world who will show up. They will appear to particular people at important moments in their lives. So, you know, we're delivering an ominous message to Laura. Don't take the ring. You know, maybe don't go to your Meals on Wheels regular routine and so on. And it's laying some important groundwork for Twin Peaks: The Return when we get to it, because it's this idea that not only is Twin Peaks not just living in isolation as a small town in the real world, but that there is almost a whole other spirit world that lays on top of ours.
And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the fact that we are adding more spirits to it, because coming in, again, having not seen the rest of season two, I was just like, okay, there's more spirits here. Maybe they got introduced and I just didn't see it. So I went into it just like, I was like, okay, I'm just going to accept that these things are here and
they're real
and just rolling with it.
Okay, so let's talk about these last 7 days of Laura's life. You know, in some regards, this is just filling in some additional details that we already knew, right? So she was dating Bobby primarily so that he could get her coke, and she doesn't really like him, but she doesn't know how to play him, and she's carrying on a secret affair with James, but also she can't be with him because he's just too good. And in some ways, again, I can understand why people might get frustrated frustrated with this or feel like it's almost redundant storytelling because we already knew a lot of this kind of stuff. But as you said earlier, we've never actually seen it play out for us. It's just that we've had other people tell us about it or we saw glimpses of it in that camera footage or in dreams.
Exactly. And I was thinking as I was watching this that I was like, okay, yes, I did have in the back of my mind, yes, this is all kind of stuff that we kind of knew from other characters. But as you suggest, the fact that we're seeing it from her perspective lends more authenticity to what is being told because everyone in Twin Peaks always seems to have something to hide and mm-hmm. they don't always seem to be telling the true story. And so the fact that we get from Laura Palmer's perspective through this, for the rest of this movie, just kind of allowed me to appreciate the plotting in the show when there mm-hmm. is plotting about her character and her death, just the way that this sort of, okay, this clues me in here. This is why that happened later on. This is why she gets off the motorcycle. Like all these little moments that, mm-hmm. that I remembered from the show just all of a sudden felt fuller and more, explained more really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not going to lie, some of these moments do so much to portray Laura as a real person. Like, there's this moment where, you know, Laura's got a ton of stuff on her mind. She's dealing with a crap ton of shit, but she also has just little regular moments, like when she and Donna go back to, I think it's Donna's house, and they're sitting on the couches, and Laura is sitting upside down in hers, like she can't even fit on furniture regularly. That's how at odds with the environment she is, because she is on her way out from this world. And they're talking about how gorgeous James is and how nice he is. And you can see that Donna is already in love with James because of the way she talks about him. And you can already tell that Laura, well, agreeing with Donna, can't think of him that way because she's so obsessed with death and she can feel it. It seems like she already knows that she's about to die. Like she's waiting for this inevitability to finally catch up with her. And these scenes do so much to flesh her out as a real teenage girl. She's not exactly coping with normal, relatable problems because I didn't know a lot of drug addicted, sex working teenage girls in my day. It seems like a bit of a stretch for most people. And yet the intimate details paint Laura as a real person. And that makes her easy to root for on top of the fact that, you know, every time we get even, you know, a glimpse of the clock and it's 8 p.m. and you're like, how many more days do we have left? Like, when is she going to get to the trailer? When is she going to leave James on the bike? When is she going, like, is this the last conversation she's going to have with her mom and so on? And that is just really hard to watch.
It really is. And I'm glad that you do bring up the scene with Donna when they go back to the house, because I loved that little moment because it started out as sort of like, you know, two girls are talking about boys, they're talking mm-hmm. about, you know, crushes. And yeah. then Donna is asking about if you fell in space, would you slow down or go faster and faster?
For Donna, it's a hypothetical. And for Laura, you feel like, oh no, she's actually thought about this because she is living it right now.
And she is unmoored in space and she is going faster and faster. Like as the movie progresses, she is moving quicker and quicker towards her demise. And so then this last bit about bursting into fire forever, which of mm-hmm. course, fire walk with me. There's a lot yep. of, you know, that is a big theme in this film and the show to a degree. And then she talks about and the part that made me really sad and I had to write down is the fact that, and the angels wouldn't help you because they've all gone away. Mm-hmm. And it's like this moment that sounds poetic, but at the same time, when you start to look at this in reference to her character, she is, there's no hope for her. And she doesn't Mm-mm. see anyone that's going to reach out at the very end and just extend a hand to help save her. And that immediately just made me like, really, really sad for this character in ways that I never did feel in the show. Sure, I felt sad because, you know, it's a kid's life cut short. Mm-hmm. We know horrible things happened to her, but like this is a moment where she sees inevitability of her death coming at her faster and faster. And it just sets the tone for this movie and her journey, her final journey here at least, in such a painful way.
It also has this great payoff later, right? When she notices that the angel has disappeared from Miss Chalfont's painting that she gave her, that she hung on the wall. And it really symbolizes, oh, that moment that you were talking about, which seemed like a hypothetical, very poetic line earlier, has now actually come to pass. And we realize that this is the last night. But then it comes full circle when at the end of the film, Laura has gone through this absolutely horrible experience. We've had to see her be murdered. The way Lynch shoots it, it's another just absolutely surreal nightmare tableau moment on the train car. And we've seen her, you know, well, her dad and also Bob carry her in the plastic and dump the body. But then we get to see her with the angel in the lodge, and it actually ends this incredibly dark, bleak film on this moment of, you know what, it's actually not that bad, because even though Laura is dead, in some way she has found a sort of silver lining in the afterlife where the angel has come back for her.
Absolutely. And I love the fake out with this, because we have this establishment in the beginning that, you know, that she's saying that there are no angels. We are going to go faster and faster to our oblivion. And then when she is murdered and Ronette is going to escape, Ronette sees the angel first. Mm-hmm. And it was like this moment of like, oh, there's no angel for Laura.
Yeah.
Ronette is okay. She's going to escape. But Laura is gone and there's nothing there to save her. And then we get this sort of, as you said, a little bit of a happy silver lining towards the end that no, there is someone there for her, and it's gonna be there for her in this afterlife or whatever Twin Peaks' version of what's happening after is gonna happen. But I love that sort of fake out, because it made me sad when Ronette got the angel, and of course, you know, she didn't. But then at the very end, there's the angel comes back.
So can we pivot to talk a little bit about Leland Palmer? Because you referenced something near the top of the episode where you said we now have a better understanding of who Bob is or what he wants and his motivation. And I thought that was really interesting, because I wanted to go into this conversation to ask you if you understood or what your thoughts were on whether Leland was always possessed by Bob. Like, was Bob in his body all the time? Or did you think that Bob was just showing up at sort of intervals and Leland was sometimes cognizant or lucid of who he really was? Because I feel like the movie in some ways gives you both a clear answer, and yet it also muddies it.
No, you're right. It does. And I don't know how to answer that exactly. I do. I think mostly for me, the idea that Bob was very interested in possessing Laura, it seemed like.
Okay. And
with the fact of there's the mirror at the very end, it seems as if Bob, for whatever reason, we don't necessarily know why, or at least I didn't get a feeling for why, but it seems like he, for whatever reason, wants to covet her and experience life through her. And so we have that aspect of it going into here. And I think that is what I was like latching onto. But in regards to whether Leland was always possessed by Bob or not, I honestly could not tell you. I could see it both ways, to be perfectly honest, of this creature that is just sort of maybe lurking in the background and then comes in like a passenger that ends up taking control at certain points in him. I could see that. But then there's also this idea of the mirror image, and that's how he's trying to get into Laura, and mirrors and doppelgangers are so important in Twin Peaks. So like I don't really have a good answer for that.
it was, I don't think there is a right answer. I think you can probably make an argument for either. I think this movie maybe gently sides with the idea that there are times when Leland is himself. And to me, some of the best dramatic moments where the movie makes me very uncomfortable, not around Laura's demise, but particularly around the incestuous relationship with Leland and Laura, is that moment where she comes to the dinner table and he is obviously Bob levels of possessed, and he yells at her because she hasn't washed her hands. And it's also a really great moment for Grace Zabriskie as her mother, because you can tell that she knows something is wrong, and that's why she screams and she starts crying, but also she wants to lie to herself. She wants to pretend that nothing is happening. And then later on that night, before he goes to bed, Leland seems to be back to his self, and he apologizes to Laura and he kisses her on the head like a father would. And then, of course, you know, we'll see him sneak through her window and rape her later on in the film. And it's, I just think these moments are so good. And I think the way that Ray Wise is playing this performance, particularly in this film, we've always seen Leland as either the sad, grief-stricken father or the kind of, oh, I've lost my mind, my hair's gone white in the series. And this is a properly dramatic performance.
It truly is. And I would say that I think that might be why this movie kind of resonated with me more as well, because you could strip out the idea of him being possessed by some malevolent spirit. Mm-hmm. And you could just look at, this is a way that abuse typically happens, where you have a person that does something bad. And then while they're on their own, they start to feel bad about it and they go back and apologize, whether they're doing it out of pure guilt for it or whether they're doing it as sort of a way of trying to hurt and then cajole back. Like there's different tactics that abusers do with that. However, the fact that we have grounded this in a situation where he does something bad and then he's like, I feel really bad about it, I'm going to go apologize to her and, you know, and try to be that loving father figure. And then, as you suggest, later on, he is enacting sexual violence upon his daughter later. Like that just, it's so grounded, so that even though we have the supernatural weird rooms and backwards, forwards talking and all of this stuff happening, the drama is grounded and gritty and feels very real. And I do think that might be why, as you suggested earlier, that incest survivors and abuse survivors come up to the actress to talk about it and talk about being seen in it. Because I do think from a very grounded perspective, you could read this as a way in which an abuser happens to be dealing with the abused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously we can't go without singling out Cheryl Lee for basically anchoring this movie. You know, Laura is in nearly every scene in the hour and 45 minutes that documents the last 7 days of Laura Palmer's life. And the moments, particularly around Leland, like when she starts to realize that it is him or that he is Bob or whatever. Ugh. And she just looks at him and she begins to cry and hyperventilate is so impactful. Like she is in some ways giving a very histrionic performance in certain parts of the film, like particularly in those final moments in the train car, when all hell is breaking loose, she's just screaming her fucking head off. And it is so upsetting. But these quiet moments, these domestic moments with her father, I think are just as effective. And I'm saying affective with an A, because they're so emotionally raw, but she's not going to that big 11 level, because you can see it's Laura trying to process what's happening. And like, she's almost crying uncontrollably because there's something wrong and she doesn't quite know, or she's just starting to accept it. And it's like, that's my dad. And also that's the man who rapes me.
I just got shivers. I was thinking about the scene where Mike swerves around and they're like stuck behind the logging truck, and Mike swerves around and is shouting that Bob is Leland or Leland is Bob, and she's screaming. Mm-hmm. And so she doesn't quite hear it, but then they pull off. And after this moment of pure histrionics and very loud, we have a very quiet moment where she is starting to like put things together. And at the same time, I think Leland is starting to like remember things that maybe happened when Bob was possessing him. The idea of him with Teresa. And again, that's why I think it's important to bring Teresa into this with the prologue, where he's with her and he literally states that she's like his daughter, that looks like his daughter. Yeah. And it's like, it's so horrifying at that moment, but you get to see these little glimpses of maybe him being possessed by Bob. And it's, starting to dawn on him as well that he might have this other life that he doesn't really remember happening. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, his daughter is starting to come to grips at this moment that, wait, these things are starting to line up in very unfortunate ways where she, you know, she asks him about being at the house when she saw Bob, which, by the way, that sequence, horrifying. But there's all these little moments that is starting to like come together for her. And it is those quiet moments, in particular that one, that really stood out to me.
And the ridiculous thing is that if you isolate that moment with the two of them, it's two actors sitting in a parked car.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be effective in any way. And yet, because of the groundwork, because of the performances, because of how much we have invested in these, and in some ways, I think this is only possible because this is a full-on R-rated movie that follows on the heels of two seasons of television. Like, you can't pack in this level of rawness in a feature film that doesn't have any kind of groundwork, right? Because we just wouldn't care about these characters in the same way. And I think that that is something that is so fascinating, because it'd be really easy to dismiss this as it's a prequel that's already giving us a story we know the end of, and therefore it doesn't really matter that much. And yet, I think to do so dismisses how effective it is doing that, or how much it's furthering a story we thought we already knew. And it turns out we didn't understand any of the nuance or the small moments that really build up to make a tragedy.
I'm glad you bring this up, because there was a guest, and the timing just didn't work out, but there was a guest on Scarred for Life that was going to come on and talk about this movie.
Oh, okay.
I was like, I had never seen anything from Twin Peaks, except for a couple episodes of the first season.
Okay.
And I was like, am I going to be able to understand what's going on in this movie if we do this? Because otherwise, I don't know how much help I'm going to be in having a conversation about it. And he's like, yeah, you'll understand it. You'll get it. You don't need to know the rest of the show. And I would completely disagree, because while this does, from a plot perspective, while this does have a very, you know, a beginning, middle, end, you can watch this. I can understand what is happening. I don't need to know what is happening in the rest of the show to understand this little segment of it. Without these two seasons, or a season and a half from what I've seen, without that sort of being the baseline for this, I don't think this movie would be as resonant as it would be just to watch it as on a lark. I'm going to watch this new David Lynch film.
Right. Yeah. And I can't help but wonder, sadly, if that was part of what contributes to its initial box office failure and even critical revilement. Is that a word? Revilement? Probably not. Anyway,
I think it might be, but
because I feel like, you know, if I'm thinking of your and my experience, you and I watch a lot of TV and we review films. But I think there's a lot of film critics who concern themselves primarily with film, and I don't know that they watch a bunch of TV. And this is straddling that line between, yeah, sure, you can watch this and review it in isolation as a 2-hour and 14-minute David Lynch movie, and you can get something out of it. But if you aren't as well versed in this world, even if you just read about it, like you said yourself, you know, you're still missing parts of that because you don't know all of the ins and outs. You haven't gone on the journey with these characters. And I wonder if there were just a bunch of fans who said, fuck you, you're not resolving the things I'm really interested in. I kept up with you for two seasons and now you're not giving me a payoff. Or I jump ship. You don't have any new story to tell me because I already know who killed Laura Palmer. Or the people who are like, hey, can I just go and watch this new David Lynch movie at the cinemas this weekend? Like, that is a lot of juggling to negotiate. And I think this movie was always going to be a hard sell. And I think at the end of the day, it was too much to overcome.
So I know that this premiered at Cannes Film Festival in 1982. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of back and forth as to whether it was booed and jeered because
rumors and speculation.
because I did find this article from The Guardian from, when was it, 2017, that references it. But then there's also an article from Den of Geek it's an interview with the co-screenwriter Robert Ingles, who says that didn't happen. So here's the thing: if it did happen, it would not surprise me, because I'm sure there are plenty of critics that went there who were like, ooh, another David Lynch joint, I'm going to watch this. And then they don't get it. And right. they're just like, what is the big deal? This is just a standard murder mm-hmm. mystery with some weird ghost that is possessing someone. Like, I could understand going into this as you were suggesting, as a film critic, not understanding TV or not having seen the show in its entirety and being like, what the fuck, David Lynch? What yeah. are you doing here? So I can understand in like hindsight why this probably got the at least the critical response that it did. Mm-hmm. And I can also understand why it might have bombed at the box office, because if you haven't been a devotee of the show, mm-hmm. I don't think there'd be an interest of going to see this. But then yeah. on the other side of things, as we kind of talked earlier, I really don't understand fans that went into this and just were upset. Yes, I can kind of understand maybe they wanted to see where the story was going to go next. Mm-hmm. I get that. But in terms of telling an important and integral part of the story, this is everything I wanted going into it, to be perfectly honest. So I don't know. It's a weird situation. It's one of those things that I don't think could possibly ever happen anymore. And I'm happy that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also sort of understand why it was sort of viewed as a failure at the time.
Yeah, I can understand. I don't personally agree with it because, as Same. We've discussed for nearly 50 minutes now, there's just too much here to dismiss as, oh, it's, you know, a failed experiment of trying to unpack a little bit of what the TV show didn't really get to capture, or we should have been season 3. And ironically enough, we're going to have both of those conversations later on when we get to Mulholland Drive, which is a mirror doppelganger of this film in that it's a failed pilot that then gets additional funding to add on an almost kind of like an epilogue in the way that this movie has a prologue that sort of stands alone, but also complements. So it's like, how do we do it in reverse with Mulholland Drive? But then we also will get season 3 of Twin Peaks when we get to The Return.
So we're going to have our cake and eat it too.
You bet your sweet fucking ass we are.
Hopefully there's a good cup of coffee, a damn good cup of coffee to wash it down with, though.
Oh, boy. Yeah. No, I'm so interested, given the conversations and some of the struggles you've had with Twin Peaks, to see how you process The Return. And I realize I feel like I've been saying that for now months over these recordings, and you're probably just like, bitch, shut up. We'll get to
it. Let's get to it. Come on.
But it's like, it's so funny because it's 25 years later.
I know.
A lot of the same things that people complained about back then, we will have those same complaints because Lynch is not changing his tune. Even though he is giving you updated and different modes of storytelling, it's still Twin Peaks and it's still Lynch, and he's still that trolley contrarian, and it's fascinating.
I'm very excited, and I'm also very excited for the next two Lynch movies that we're going to be discussing, one of which is Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious to see this back half of Lynch's filmography, because
yeah,
I've heard wild things, and it makes me really excited to finally kind of for now put a bookmark on yeah. Twin Peaks and sort of get away from it and have a little bit of a break before we return in earnest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nice to have that taste of Wild at Heart to kind of remind us of the non-Twin Peaks Lynch. But I'm excited to get into, yeah, as you said, the back half of this filmography is just really where it starts to go, nope, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want because I am not beholden to studios and financials. And some of these we're going to have lots to discuss about whether they're successful. I would argue they're always successful creatively. And then it's just a question of whether they actually satisfy audiences. And I think those are two really different things sometimes.
I mean, I think that this movie encompasses that dynamic of whether it is going to be satisfying to specific audiences and whether it is going to be creatively Lynch operating on his own terms. I did want to interject something a little bit about Wild at Heart, because mm-hmm. one thing that kind of made me laugh isn't the right thing, but it sort of like gave me a little bit of joy was with mm-hmm. the idea of the angel showing up at the very end
right.
of this, helping her. And in Wild at Heart, she is the
the fucking Wizard of Oz bullshit stuff.
Yeah. Right. But she is also extending herself out to the female character in there and helping that whole thing like come together. So I just, mm-hmm. I don't know. There's something kind of interesting going on between that dialogue between those two films that just, oh, that's kind of interesting that I probably would not have even thought of if we hadn't been watching these chronologically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something in the air, something in the water in this 1991-92 David Lynch time period, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, as you said, I mean, when we return, we'll go really far down the rabbit hole with Lost Highway, a 5-year time jump. But first, Terry, we have to go and revisit the Cronenberg side. And talking about stepping out of your comfort zone and going in different directions, it's going to be fun to talk about Madame Butterfly.
Oh, I cannot wait. Have you seen this one?
This is going to be a first time watch for me.
All right. Here we go. Let's go.
All right. Well, that'll be what we discuss next time. But until then, Terry, if people want to talk to you about The Missing Pieces or Laura's Tragedy or some other moment from Fire Walk With Me, how would they get in touch?
You will find me at Gaily Dreadful, wherever there is social media. And Joe, if people want to talk about how deliriously gorgeous Chris Isaac is, how would they get in touch with you?
Oh my gosh, please. I may have gone down. Oh my gosh, please. I definitely went into a Google search and was just like, show me pictures of Chris Isaac because I forgot. Anyway, you can reach me at Beast on My Remote, and that's the letter B. And you can also reach the show and all of the other shows on the network if you want to subscribe to the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network. So please, you know, I don't know, give us a rating and review or something. That'd be nice for a change.
Yeah, seriously. I know how that goes.
All right. Well, until we come back for Madame Butterfly, Terry... Oh boy, I can't even say something glib because this movie is just too fucking dark.
Well, you know, you can have a cup of Good Morning America. How's that?
That coffee looked disgusting.
Oh, so gross.
The Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad.